It is my very great pleasure at this time to tell you that we will now be joining Bob Perkins in our larger studios, who is about to introduce Billy Taylor to us. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia.
Thank you very much, Terry. As Adjutant George just informed you, I'm Bob Perkins. It's my pleasure to host a program that immediately precedes Jazz Alive with Mr. Taylor. Little did I know when I started in radio that I would meet this giant of a human being and of a musician. I think I first heard of Billy Taylor somewhere in the middle 1950s. I followed his career from that time on until I went into the U.S. Army, stationed in Fort Belvoir, Virginia, right outside of Washington, D.C. And thanks to the, well, I was single then, thanks to the beautiful young ladies at Howard University and Billy Taylor's music, in that order, they helped to pull me through my two-year tenure in the U.S. military. I got into broadcasting quite by accident, and I played many of this gentleman's records. I've heard so many tales and good things about him. He's a gentleman in the purest sense of the word. He is a scholar. I think Mr. Taylor has received his Ph.D., he can correct me if I'm wrong, some 3-4 years ago. And he's just a fabulous musician. He is creative, but he's also very basic. The average human being can understand what Billy Taylor does with his piano and at his piano. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, it's my great pleasure to introduce to you Mr. Billy Taylor, his piano, and as they used to say, his magic.
Thank you very much. This is a song that we play a lot in several settings. I play it with the trio, I play it solo. It stemmed from an improvisation that I did some years ago. I played at a dinner, which honored several distinguished Americans, among whom were very marvelous poet, Edward Steichen and Carl Sandburg were the two people who remain in my mind. And the organization that was honoring these fine artists was called the National Council for the Arts and Government. So they asked us to improvise something on their initials, NCAG. Well, I didn't do too much with the N, but the CAG I did this with. Thank you. Thank you very much. The blues is a very important aspect of jazz, and certainly one of the oldest forms of jazz playing. Blues on piano dates back to what used to be called the Texas style of playing, which ultimately became boogie-woogie. But even today, the various things that happen in the blues give a pianist a chance to do all kinds of interesting things, imitating human voice or just playing through the changes, many of which are not associated with the traditional blues, but which are incorporated in today's blues. Something like this. That was actually just an improvisation on Blues Changes, not really any particular blues. But one of the things that many young people have asked is, how do you go about, you say jazz is based on improvisation and the feeling of improvisation. What do you mean by improvisation? So I explained to them that jazz is America's classical music, and it's a way of playing. It's a kind of music that is not only indigenous to this country, but it says who we are and what we're about to others all around the world, as well as to ourselves. And the improvisation aspect is the medium of personal expression that is in jazz like it's in no other kind of music. One of the things that a jazz musician can do, I can do, for instance, sitting at the piano, is sit down and say something musically which is unlike what someone else would say. Now, obviously, I can play in styles that are you're familiar with, say Earl Garner or Art Tatum or Errol Hines or people like that, and say things, hopefully, in the spirit that they said them. But it's more important to me to say those things in the spirit of what I feel in jazz. For an instance, if I wrote a love song and I wanted to express a very loving feeling toward someone, the song might sound like this. Thank you. Thank you very much. Charlie Parker was a remarkable musician. I spoke about improvisation a moment ago. And his compositions, Charlie Parker's compositions, sounded like improvisations. The first eight bars, quite often, was different from the second eight bars and so forth. That's the beginning of a Charlie Parker tune. The next eight is quite different. The melody of the piece sounded like an improv. I'll show you what I mean. This is called Confirmation. One of the musicians who was most influential on my orchestral work and later, much later, became very inspirational to me as a composer. I grew up listening to his music. I learned his compositions were among the very first that I learned on the piano. His name was Duke Ellington. We come from the same town, Washington, D.C. And the Duke was just remarkable. I'd like to play two selections. One of them he wrote many years ago, and I think it's one of the greatest ballads ever written in jazz. And the other he wrote with Billy Strayhorn, and he used it as his theme song. But I like to play a slightly different version of the piece. The first one, so they're both relatively slow. The first one is this. It's called In a Sentimental Mood. Thank you. Now, the tune that I was talking about that Duke wrote along with Billy Strayhorn, they collaborated on so many of the songs that are associated with Ellentonia that were played by the band and are still played by jazz musicians all over the world. This is one that's played in a totally different context. Ray Nance, the late Ray Nance, the violinist with the band, used to play a version. He was the first one I played this particular version of this song with. It's by Billy Strayhorn and Duke Ellington, and they used to use it, as I said, as a theme. Two of my favorite pianists are people whose work is being belatedly appreciated. One is the late Thomas Fats Waller, who was the first big influence on my piano playing. And Fats Waller was a remarkable jazz musician. He was not only one of the most melodic musicians ever, he just tossed off melodies like that. He was one of the, he epitomized the kind of piano that he was famous for, which was the East Coast stride piano. It was a kind of ragtime piano. But he was really marvelous at it, and the things that he did are legendary in that regard. One of the things that is somewhat lost in the shuffle of looking at the music that Waller played was that he was one of the first really composers who composed a really swinging waltz. He called it the Jitterbug Waltz, and it's really a lovely piece of music, as well as being a very swinging waltz.
Thank you.
I'd like to, for the final part of this, just play something. I mentioned being influenced by Ellington and by Waller and by Art Tatum, and also by other people. So just in a couple of minutes that are remaining, I'd like to show you how some of that takes place in my own playing. Jazz is a way of playing. I consider it America's classical music, but it's a way of playing as well as a repertory of songs. And as demonstration of it, of jazz as a way of playing, here's a popular song by Jerome Kern, which a lot of jazz musicians, including myself, like to play. Thank you. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure for me to be here, and I'd like to thank you for being in the audience here in the studio. The nice thing about National Public Radio is that we get people who really understand what the music is about, what the talk is about, and it's a ball for me to be out. I travel a lot and playing concerts and other things that I do, as I indicated earlier, and to meet people who are a part of our audience is a big thrill for me. So thank you very much.
Billy, you've done so much to introduce people to jazz and to keep them listening to it. How did you start listening to jazz yourself?
Well, I had an uncle who I come from a musical family, and all of my father's brothers and sisters sang and played the piano, but all but two played the kind of music in church and in concerts that, we're familiar with as European classical music. It was beautiful and it was lovely, but it didn't grab me like two of my younger uncles, two of his younger brothers, would sit down and play this other stuff. And I was, very small child, but that grabbed me by the ear immediately. I knew that what Uncle Bob and Uncle Clint played was different from all the rest. And so I began to try to imitate what they did at the piano. And my mother, seeing that I was interested, gave me the usual piano lessons or had me sent me to a teacher. And so I had to learn the tradition before I could learn to play jazz. And that was very frustrating because I didn't want to practice that stuff. I wanted to play like my uncles. So I had to learn the usual Mozart and Beethoven and Brahms and the piano literature. I got disgusted and went into other instruments, played the guitar and the saxophone and drums before finally coming back to the piano and realizing that that was the instrument I really wanted to concentrate on.
You've played with a lot of people in your time and spent a period at Birdland, being the house pianist there, which must have been just a real fantastic. I would love to hear a little bit about that. I'd love to hear also a little bit about the time you spent with Charlie Parker. I'll remind our listeners that there's a double album of Charlie Parker's work that we're offering as a premium this afternoon.
Well, I got my first job in Birdland as a fluke. I got a call from Al Haig, who was Charlie Parker's pianist, and he said, Billy, Bird is opening at Birdland tonight, and I'm not going to be able to make it. Could you cover for me? So I said, sure. He needed someone who could read the parts that were going to be Bird, Charlie Parker, and strings. So I said, fine. And so I went down and went to the rehearsal and played the job that night. And at the end of the night, I went to Monte K and said, are you going to pay me, or is Al going to pay me? How will we work this? So he said, I don't know, call me tomorrow. So I called him the next day, and he said, well, Al, I didn't hear from Al, I don't know what he's doing. So make a long story short, Al never showed up for the rest of the week. So I made the week. After the week, we played the Apollo with Sir Yvonne and Stan Getz, and we did several other things with that particular group. And it was really fun, and I had played with Charlie Parker before on one-nighters, but nothing steady. And the job was over, and it was a two-week job, and I talked to Monty and said, call me again when you need me. So that night, I got a call from him, said, come on down, the pianist didn't show. Well, the pianist was Bud Powell, and so I played with what was supposed to have been the Bud Powell trio, and with Roy Haynes and I think Al McKibben that night. At any rate, to make another long story short, I kept filling in for Bud. Bud was having some mental problems at the time, and they would schedule him. He'd show up for a night or so and then disappear. And so for about two or three weeks, I was just on call. So finally, Monty said, look, why don't you just consider yourself the house pianist? When I need you, I'll call you. And so he began to call me like once a week to play with the all-star band that was always there. And so I ended up for about 2 years just playing piano with everybody, so it was a gas.
What does it do for your piano playing when, you get to play in such a variety of settings, but you know the piano? I mean, it's not, you don't have to get disoriented from traveling and from having a new and broken down piano every night.
It was fascinating because someone like Dizzy would come in and he would be organized and he'd have the things that he you know, that he'd written and he'd arranged and said, this is the way I want to play it. Another guy would come in, Kenny Dorham or somebody, and he'd say, hey, I don't know, let's try this line. And we kind of experiment and fool around and do different things. And it would be fun because the musicians, it was a period of getting it together. And Blakey, really, Art Blakey, was working as a side man. He couldn't sustain the Jazz Messengers yet, and it wasn't a big enough name. And so I'd work with him and Clyde Lombardi, or I'd work with Joe Jones and Oscar Pettiford. And, you know, it was all kinds of rhythm sections and all kinds of Roy Haynes and Curly Russell. And, you know, it was each week it would be a different kind of feeling. And the feeling of the rhythm section would change if you were working with Blakey, or another time you were working with Joe Jones. It's a totally different feeling. So it was like going to school. It really was a gas.
Your career really fascinates me because you've had like two parallel careers in jazz. One as a performer and composer, and the other as someone who's just a really eloquent spokesperson for the music and has been able to really introduce new audiences to jazz, which is just terribly important to jazz's continuation. Not that the music itself is ever in danger of dying, but it seems to go in and out of commercial success through the years. You've been playing for a number of years now and have seen jazz like kind of go up and go down as far as its marketability. Can you talk a little bit about how you started to use your own facilities as someone to like talk about jazz to people, to get it to them, both on the radio and through things like the Jazzmobile? Maybe we should start with the radio first, Billy.
Well, I guess the radio and other things stem from the fact that my academic work in college and later in postgraduate work was in education. And so I guess I really am somewhat of a teacher in terms of orientation. I also, when I first went to college, was going to be a sociologist. So those two things seem to come and go within my own frame of reference. I'm very concerned about the communities in which I live. I'm very concerned about the people that live in those communities. So I consider radio a paramount way, perhaps the most exemplary way, to reach the widest segment of the public. And so I used it as such. We said on WLIB when I was there that we were the voice of the community, that we spoke to and for the community, speaking to people who the community couldn't reach in the way that we could, speaking to those same people, voicing concerns of the community to them, to the mayor, to whoever, to say, hey, look, I mean, check this out. I mean, we are really concerned, and we can't get you on the phone, or we can't, you won't see us when we come to City Hall. So this is what we're talking about. And so that was a concern that I found worked quite well with those same people's interest in jazz.
I just want to remind our listeners that while we're talking, they are welcome, more than welcome, invited, courteously invited. Please give us a call at 243-1234.
Let me echo that. I mean, because the numbers are the 800 number, 228-5000, and the one right here, 243-1234, is one that I certainly would see. I'm looking at some lights that are not lighting up. So if you would light those lights up, I'd be happy to continue to talk. But if you don't, I'm going to shut up.
Okay, that sounds like a threat to me. 243-1234 is the phone number. We have a number of premiums for you, including our program guide. What we want right now is your support. WLIB was not a public station. Actually, that was, before the creation of National Public Radio. There were non-commercial stations at the time, but there was no NPR.
They didn't need to be.
Well, I hear a lot of, people who've played jazz on radio stations and former jazz radio stations complaining that you just can't make a go of it playing jazz. LIB did it for a period and then they stopped. Was it really difficult to keep jazz a commercially viable thing on the radio?
What it's about is a matter of commitment and it's a matter of doing your homework. I took a year off from playing and really did my homework on jazz records. I mean, I had a large jazz collection and I thought I was pretty knowledgeable. But when I began to program for a radio station with trying to do something interesting every day and competing with gospel, with rock and roll, with all of the other kinds of commercial radio, what it was about was knowing what was available and being able to put that together in some kind of way that would grab people by the ear. In order to do that, you've got to listen to the music. You've got to know. It's not enough for me to know Charlie Parker personally. I've got to know what he's got on records and how that fits into a programmatic scheme. And so I use my knowledge of the musicians to have a general idea of where they were coming from stylistically, but to put it together in a way that made some kind of sense. Now, you don't have to be a musician to do that. And what I really object to with most of the people that make the kind of complaints you were talking about, jazz is not definable and we can't do the kinds of things that'll grab people by the ear. You don't have to explain it. It'll explain itself if you program properly. And verbal program notes are welcome. You can tell people who are playing and who's on the record and the things that they may not know. But the music, if properly programmed, will compete with anything out there. We were on a 1,000-watt daytime station, and I got a job. I was hired away from WLIB by WNEW, which was the Clear Channel 50,000-watt station in New York, the biggest independent in town at that time, because I kept showing up on their surveys against William B. Williams, who was making like 70 times what I was making on the radio as a disc jockey, you know? But they said, well, who the devil is this guy that keeps showing up in our surveys? So they checked me out and said, well, let's try that over here. I mean, you know, we'll put him on our station if he's doing that well. And what was happening is that people were listening.
Well, you did something really subversive. You ended up playing John Coltrane on WNEW, which I find amazing, considering it always seemed that most of their format was devoted to people like Stephen Edie Gourmet and, you know, pop singers of the time who were doing cover recordings of rock and roll and songs that no rock and roller had ever done and never would do. let me just take a moment out from this conversation to remind you, listen, we need your pledge of support. We need it now at 243-1234. Billy Taylor and I are in the studios. We really want to hear those phones ring. Okay, so let's just take out a moment. I know it's hard for you to call while Billy's talking because he's so interesting to listen to. So I'll just talk for a minute and you can call then, okay? 243-1234. Remember that for a $20 pledge, you receive our program guide, and we have four great jazz double albums for you for a pledge of $30 or more that you can choose from. Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, Fletcher Henderson, Fats Waller. You can have your choice of those recently reissued albums. And for a $50 pledge, you can choose two. For a $60 pledge, three. A $75 pledge, and you can choose all four. And we've got the Smithsonian Collection of Classic Jazz for a pledge of $100 or more. And that's really some set. That's a really great set. So please get to your phone. Tell us that you want to continue hearing things like the live concert that Billy Taylor treated us to this afternoon. The way to tell us that is to call 243-1234. I'd like to thank I'd like to thank Gary McInnes of Philadelphia for a very generous pledge, and he'll be receiving a number of our double albums that we're offering as premiums this afternoon. And thank you, Peter Wood of Lawrenceville, New Jersey, for your pledge. And thank you also for your comments. We're at 243-1234. We do have a number of phone lines open. Billy, what's some of the differences for you, or aren't there many, between working in a context like WLIB, which was, you know, was rooted in a space, you know, in New York City, and you know, you had that kind of direct contact with your audience. It was also a commercial station and had a, you know, certain profits that it had to meet. Between doing that and doing Jazz Alive now for National Public Radio, which is a kind of different context. It's also a performance show. It's not a disc show, which is what you were referring to before.
Well, oddly enough, I used to try to do this on LIB. I had several formats that I used in my program in which I would play records of live performances, because I learned very early that a live concert at Monterey or a concert from the Newport Jazz Festival or Jazz at the Philharmonic or something was totally different from that same artist playing in a recording studio. And so the excitement and the immediacy of that performance was quite different than studio performances. So I used to do that as much as I could. Those cuts tended to be a little longer, and so I couldn't do it as often as I would like to because of commercial considerations. But on Jazz Alive, we just go into various places, and the problem is not the length of the songs, but really just trying to get to fit diverse elements together and have people who might not listen to a performer that they didn't know, whose name they didn't know, to hear that that performer is indeed a beautiful player, a player from this area that I know. John Coates is a fine pianist that many people who live in the area are not aware of. And so we played him on National Public Radio and got a lot of fine comments about, who is that guy? Gee, he sure can play. Of course he can. And many musicians like that all over the country we're finding out about them in Iowa and in Minnesota and in Texas and in a lot of places. And it gives us a great deal of pleasure when we can to present them on National Public Radio.
It's great to have a program like that back on the air. I mean, I look back and I think of all like the live concerts from Birdland and other places that used to be broadcast. And I mean, hearing Charlie Parker on the radio say, wow, God, imagine what it was like to turn on your radio and hear Charlie Parker play live. Well, now you can turn on your radio and hear live or live on tape concerts from Jazz Alive. And I mean, that's a really great opportunity. And what you're saying is really true about that balance between the more known people and the more unknown people. Do you feel, Billy, like there's a certain obligation to make sure, though, that some of the great pop successes of jazz, some of the people who are really big draws, get to appear on the show?
Oh, sure.
Not
for the obvious reason, though. The reasons that we try to include some of the commercial success, people who had commercial success like Chick Corea and Herbie Hancock and people like that, is that they are creative artists. And whatever they do, in most cases, especially the live performances, show a different aspect of that creativity. Joe Zawinul, people like that, who are enjoying currently great attention. And yet, you hear that person, for instance, you hear Chick and Herbie play the acoustic piano together, and that's a whole other thing from Return to Forever and some of the other things that Chick does, or the Headhunters that Herbie did. And these are the same musicians. No one is... most jazz musicians are not singular. I mean, a person can be a father, a husband, a boyfriend, or an uncle. It can be the same person relates to different people in different ways, different situations in different ways. Musicians are just like that.
Let me remind our listeners of our phone number, which is 243-1234. Let's get those phones ringing again. 243-1234. I do, and I'm sure our listeners do, want to hear about your personal preferences, your personal tastes in jazz now, because there are people playing in many different genres. You know, we have a lot of people in the avant-garde and a lot of people who have combined, rock forms and jazz forms, and people who are playing more traditional forms of jazz. You strike me as being someone with a very varied collection of tastes.
Well, I must... confess to being eclectic in my taste, and I get a charge out of listening to contemporary players who play in an abstract form. I get a charge out of listening to people who are very far in, if you will. I think each jazz is a personal expression, and you, in the same way that you would relate to someone who's manner of communicating with you verbally wasn't as clear as someone else, but you were interested in what he or she had to say, and you would take the time and the effort to really try to understand that person. I remember years ago playing Thelonious Monk on the radio and playing Eric Dolphy and playing people that whose music wasn't as accessible as Cannonball Adderley or other players who were playing from a different point of view. And I found that I could find things in there, something different in listening to Ornette Coleman, something different in listening to Cecil Taylor. And it's not to the exclusion of Bill Evans or Oscar Peterson or some other pianist or some other musician. I think people who close doors to themselves and say, I can only listen to this or I can only listen to that, present problems for themselves. I don't... crossover is very exciting to me because musicians are taking new instruments, computers and synthesizers and things, and doing remarkable things with them. There's nothing wrong with the instruments, but the creativity of the musician, if he has to stretch his imagination over six or seven instruments simultaneously, something may happen to him. He may not be up to it, and I can see a problem there, but I don't think that should stop anybody from trying.
I guess that viewpoint is also represented in the Jazzmobile, which is another project of yours, one that you started in 1965 and continues to grow and become more and more important.
Well, Jazzmobile has grown from one outdoor program to an organization which has seven programs. And we have school lecture program where we go into graded schools and everything from graded schools to high schools and do lecture concerts. We have a workshop. We have an ESA program, which is Artists in the Schools program. We have a CETA band. And we have a lot of things that do two things. All of our programs involve professional musicians on a level of giving them opportunities to do what they do and upgrading their talents through the experience of doing these things. And they expose well-known and not so well-known people to people who wouldn't in whose consciousness they would not invade. You know, people just wouldn't be exposed to them.
Okay, well, Billy, I know that you have to leave us. I'm really sorry that you do. I surely wish that we had some more time to talk. Maybe at some time in the future you can rejoin us here at WUHY if you're in town. I'd surely love that. Billy, it's been a great pleasure having you here this afternoon, both for your conversation and your concert, which I greatly enjoyed.
Thank you.
Wish you the best with all your projects. Billy Taylor is a pianist and composer whose work we heard a little earlier this afternoon during a live concert which he performed in our studios. And you can hear Billy Taylor also every Saturday night here on WUHY through the National Public Radio program Jazz Alive, which he hosts each week, and bringing us a variety of concert performances by some of the great jazz performers of our time. Billy, I'm really sorry you have to leave. Have a terrific afternoon and evening.
Thank you very much, Terry. Just before I leave, I'd once again like to compliment you on your show. It's a tremendous show. I have only heard since I talked to you on the phone. I just got an opportunity to have a quick listen. I was passing through on the way from, Camden. And so I got a chance to hear just a little of your show a couple of weeks ago when I was in the area, and I enjoyed it so very much. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, great. Thank you, Billy Taylor. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. We're at 243-1234. We're going to hear now another of Billy Taylor's compositions. It's the one that I first heard of his that got me listening to him and got me listening to a lot more jazz. This is a tune called I Wish I Knew What It's Like to Be Free. Billy Taylor playing his own I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free, a tune that has also been recorded by Nina Simone and by Leontine Price.